Good day, and welcome to the CBP Cases Program. Currently, all lines are in a listen-only mode. Later, there'll be an opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register at any time during today's program to ask a question by pressing the star, then one on your touch-tone phone. Please be advised, today's program is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the program over to Ms. Trina Realmuto. Ms. Realmuto, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Trina Realmuto, and I'm a staff attorney with the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild. I'd like to welcome everyone to our briefing on the 10 lawsuits and administrative complaints that were filed this week against U.S. Customs and Border Protection arising from abuse and misconduct in Texas, Washington, Ohio, and New York. Following this conference call, which is being recorded, we will be distributing a press release about the lawsuits. I also want to let people know that summaries of the recently filed cases, as well as summaries of some previously filed cases challenging CBP abuse out of California, Washington, Ohio, and Texas, have been made available online. To access the summaries, please go to legalactioncenter.org/CBP-abuse-authority. That's legalactioncenter.org/CBP-abuse-authority. That page also lists points of contact for each individual case and will also be the location of the posting of this recording. You may also contact Wendy Felice at telephone number 202-507-7524, who will provide contact information for the appropriate person. By filing and publicizing these cases, we hope to shed light on the misconduct and abuse that regularly occurs in states along both the northern and southern borders, and to promote accountability for government abuse. Before I introduce today's speakers, I'd like to make two quick points about the cases filed this week. First, for every example of CBP abuse exposed through these cases, there are scores of similar incidents of abuse that go unreported. These cases highlight abuses such as racially motivated arrests, threats, battery, and deprivation of humane detention facilities. However, a significant number of CBP abuses go unreported, often due to fear of retribution or the potential adverse impact that speaking up could have on a person's immigration case, or the person may not know about their rights, or there's a lack of counsel to help file a complaint. Second, while these cases seek damages in the form of monetary compensation, we hope they will highlight the need for agency accountability. CBP is a law enforcement agency. It's axiomatic that agencies expected to enforce laws should not break the law. Therefore, it is especially important to hold the agency and individuals, officers, accountable when law enforcement officers violate the law. By filing these cases, we are aiming to send the message to CBP that it is not above the law. It's especially important that we get this message out now while Congress is considering comprehensive immigration reform. So who's involved in this effort? It was spearheaded by four organizations, the National Immigration Project in Boston, the Northwest Immigrants' Rights Project in Seattle, the American Immigration Council in Washington, D.C., and the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties in San Diego. The Northwest Immigrants' Rights Project and the ACLU of San Diego are members of larger coalitions of immigrant advocacy organizations along the northern and southern border. The National Immigration Project and the American Immigration Council are national immigrant rights organizations that, among other things, engage in accountability litigation and support attorneys seeking to do the same. In addition to these organizations, victims are represented by private attorneys, a law school clinic, and other nonprofit organizations. At this point, we will start the speaker presentations. After our speakers have presented their remarks, there will be an opportunity for questions. Our first speaker is Jackie Pierce, a law student, and Professor Betsy Ginsburg from the Immigrant Justice Clinic at Cardozo School of Law in New York. Jackie will discuss their case, and she and Betsy will be available to answer questions at the conclusion of the presentations. Jackie?
Thanks, Trina. Yesterday, I and two other law students, Brittany Nunez and Sarah Chelson, under the supervision of attorneys Betsy Ginsburg and Lindsay Nash, filed a federal administrative complaint against CBP and ICE on behalf of Ms. Elizabeth Takamai-Shetu. Ms. Takamai-Shetu is a dark-skinned, 63-year-old resident of New York with no criminal background whatsoever. She works as a home aide to a disabled elderly widow, pays her taxes regularly, and is a devout Christian. In March 2011, she was traveling from Minnesota to New York on the way back from her cousin's funeral when her Greyhound bus made a scheduled stop in Toledo, Ohio. An armed CBP agent boarded the bus, approached her, and without any basis for believing that she was a non-citizen or any explanation, loudly demanded to know her immigration status. She was fearful and told him that she was not a U.S. citizen. The agent then made her get off the bus, took her belongings from her, and refused her request to make a phone call to her pastor. She was handcuffed and then placed in a CBP vehicle for 8 hours without any food or water. When she had requested to use the bathroom, an agent led her to the facilities at gunpoint as if she were a dangerous criminal. She was finally taken to the CBP processing center close to midnight. At the center, Ms. Takamechetu was interrogated twice. The second time, her leg was shackled to a bench. She was placed in a small cell where she had room only to sit upright. Two different CBP agents ignored her request to use the bathroom, and Ms. Takamechetu was forced to urinate on herself. She had to spend the entire night in her urine-soaked jeans, sitting upright in her small closet-sized cell. In the morning, Ms. Takamechetu was transferred to a county jail, which holds a federal contract to detain immigrants. That night, she was forced to sleep on a mattress on the floor because the cell she was placed in already had two occupants taking up the two beds. During her second day in custody, and overcome with stress and fear from her detention, Ms. Takamechetu began to feel nauseous and dizzy. Her hands started convulsing, and she dropped the Bible she was reading. She began vomiting and lost consciousness. It was later confirmed that Ms. Takamechetu suffered a left cerebellar stroke while in ICE custody. Doctors treating her informed ICE that they had to release her if they could not provide the care necessary for her post-stroke rehabilitation. Ms. Takamechetu was detained for a total of 10 days by the time ICE released her on her own recognizance because they could not provide the care she needed and the doctors had mandated. After numerous tests and examinations, her treating physician in New York concluded that she exhibited none of the risk factors for stroke, and that the stroke was the sole result of the extreme stress of this experience. A previously healthy woman with no medical problems, Ms. Takamechetu continues to suffer from the physical effects of the stroke, with near constant pain, numbness, and partial paralysis on the left side of her body. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. Our second speaker is Matt Adams, who is the legal director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. He will address the prevalence of the problem of CBP abuse along the border. Matt?
Thanks, Trina. So over the last 6 and 7 years, there's been a dramatic expansion of the presence of Border Patrol. In some places, like Washington State, we've seen a tenfold increase in the number of Border Patrol agents. However, this increase in the number of agents does not reflect the need, as the new resources are not even dedicated to the agency's traditional mission of protecting the border. Rather, there's several astonishing patterns that have emerged. Repeated cases around the country demonstrate on a daily basis that a vast amount of the Border Patrol's resources are not targeting border activity. Instead, we see case after case of agents patrolling highways hours away from any land crossing, pulling over cars where there's no even suspicion that the vehicle or the occupants are coming from a border. Rather, Border Patrol agents are casting wide nets in the hope of finding persons without legal immigration status in order to justify their expanded numbers. This, in turn, has led to a pattern of practices violating the civil rights both of citizens and non-citizens. Here in Washington State, for example, the Border Patrol has apparently so little to do that they volunteer their officers to act as 9/11 dispatchers for three different communities. This dramatic expansion of resources has led to an even greater disconnect in the communities where the Border Patrol operates. And I think this is due in large part to the lack of accountability and oversight. Many of the cases that come before us demonstrate a culture of impunity and an agency that is rarely held accountable for its actions. These abuses affect both citizens and non-citizens, and they run the gamut as far as how egregious the violations have been. Over the last couple of years, there have been class actions filed against Border Patrol in both Washington State and Ohio, targeting broad practices of racial profiling. There have also been cases filed regarding individuals killed by Border Patrol and other victims of severe physical violence. But this week we've come together filing cases all over the country, which will hopefully further demonstrate this widespread pattern of abuse. There are hundreds of other cases in addition out there where no complaints have been filed. But what all the cases demonstrate is a lack of accountability and the lack of controls for an agency that has experienced historic levels of expansion and continues to have so many additional resources funneled its way. Thanks, Trina.
Thank you, Matt. Our next speaker will be Joe Anderson, who is the Director of Litigation at Americans for Immigrant Justice in Miami, Florida. Along with Lozman Jimenez, Joe is representing some of the victims of CBP abuse and will speak to us about his cases.
This is Joseph Anderson, Director of Litigation for Americans for Immigrant Justice, a national immigrant rights organization. Every week, AI justice attorneys visit immigrant detention centers where they conduct Know Your Rights presentations for hundreds of immigrant men, women, and children. Earlier this year, we began to hear similar stories from dozens of these individuals concerning the conditions they endured after being taken into custody by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. AI Justice has now spoken to more than 50 immigrants in detention, all of whom reported enduring the same inhumane treatment. One of these women, who I will refer to using the pseudonym Amelia, has agreed to let us share her story with you. Amelia is a 28-year-old mother of three who, after being repeatedly beaten by her spouse, fled to the United States with her two sisters and her 5-year-old niece. Shortly after arriving in the U.S., they were arrested by Customs and Border Protection officers who told them they were being taken to a yalera. In English, yalera means the freezer or ice box. The yalera turned out to be a freezing cold cell where Amelia and her family were locked up along with many other immigrant women. The yalera had no beds, no chairs, and a single sink and a single toilet sitting in plain view in the corner of the cell. The temperature in the cell was so cold that Amelia's lips chapped and split. Her face began to hurt, and it eventually peeled. Her sister's and her 5-year-old niece's lips and fingers turned blue because of the cold. They were all forced to sleep on the concrete floor without even so much as a blanket. They huddled together on the floor at nights for warmth, but managed to sleep very little. They were provided no access at any time to a bath or a shower. They were not provided with even the most basic personal hygiene products, like a toothbrush, toothpaste, a comb, or even soap. They were never provided with a change of clothing. They were only fed once or twice a day and received no more than a single bologna sandwich for each meal. They were constantly hungry and suffered headaches as a result. The only water available to them and the other women in the cell was provided in a single thermos shared by all of the detainees. There were no cups to drink the water. The water smelled like bleach, and it burned their throats when they drank it. Amelia was incarcerated in the yalera for 6 days. We have now spoken to women who were kept in these conditions for as long as 2 weeks. To escape the yaleras, many of these women agreed to sign documents that they could neither read nor understand, which turned out to be orders for their expedited removal from the United States. On March 12, 2013, AI Justice filed federal administrative tort claims on behalf of Amelia and three other immigrant detainees subject to these inhumane and outrageous conditions. Americans for Immigrant Justice will take full legal action to bring these inhumane and unlawful practices to an immediate end. We call on Customs and Border Protection to immediately investigate these unlawful practices and to bring to an immediate end this inhumane and needlessly cruel treatment of these immigrant families. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Next, we will hear directly from one of the complainants, Lucy Rogers, who will talk about her experience with CBP in upstate New York. Ms. Rogers is represented by the New York Civil Liberties Union and the Immigrant Justice Clinic at Cardozo School of Law. Lucy?
Hi. My name is Lucy Rogers. I'm a U.S. citizen of Mexican descent. I work for a regional healthcare network in upstate New York, providing transportation and interpretation services to Spanish-speaking farm workers who need medical treatment. Unfortunately, Latino residents in these regions have learned to fear the Border Patrol. We know that at any moment we can be stopped and forced to prove our citizenship. I am a U.S. citizen. Why should I be the object of suspicion simply because of the color of my skin? On December 28, 2011, I was driving two Latino farm workers to dentist appointments near the U.S.-Canada border. I passed a Border Patrol agent who was parked on the roadside. The agent started following me. After a few minutes, he pulled me over. He approached my driver's side window and told me that he was conducting a citizenship checkup. He asked whether I was a U.S. citizen. I gave him my driver's license, but the agent arrested me. He grabbed my keys from my hand and refused to allow me to call my husband. I was handcuffed and forced to sit in the back of the agent's patrol car for about an hour. Then I was taken to the Border Patrol station at Ogdensburg, New York. I was searched, interrogated, and placed in a cell for several hours. Border Patrol agents took my car's GPS device and pressured me into allowing them to search it. I spent more than 3 hours in custody, but I was never charged with any crime. This was a humiliating and intimidating experience. I should be able to go about my business without having to constantly worry about being stopped by Border Patrol and forced to show my papers. That's not what living in America is supposed to be about. Today's action sends CBP a clear message. Stop harassing and intimidating people who live in border communities. Thank you, Tricia. Trina.
Thank you, Lucy. Our final speaker is Melissa Crow, Director of the Legal Action Center at the American Immigration Council. Melissa will discuss how CBP may be impacted by comprehensive immigration reform.
Thank you, Trina. Border security has been a critical element of every push for immigration reform, and this year is going to be no exception to that rule. Many members of Congress have already called for heightened border enforcement, and this sentiment seems to be echoed in the Senate bipartisan framework. Even the leaked White House draft, while acknowledging that the borders are more secure than at any time in history, calls for increased investments in border security and infrastructure. While border security is certainly important, enforcement cannot come at the expense of civil rights. The cases that have been filed in the past few days, as well as the many others that we've referenced, illustrate that lawmakers must think carefully about how CBP is using its resources, whether additional resources are really needed, and how they should be channeled. The upcoming immigration reform debates have to be about more than meeting benchmarks, all of which have been met in the past. They also must include how CBP will hold its officers accountable for misconduct and prevent them from using unlawful tactics in the future. We're very pleased that both the bipartisan Senate framework and the White House draft acknowledge the need for better training for CBP officers, increased oversight of the agency, a mechanism to ensure meaningful input from border communities, and stronger civil rights protections, which should include an explicit ban on racial profiling. We hope that the outrageous facts of the 10 new cases that have been filed will put a human face on the problems and give lawmakers a much better sense of what it will take to find a solution. As some of the other speakers have already noted, these 10 cases are really just the tip of the iceberg. We hope that the courageous plaintiffs in these cases will motivate many other people who've suffered abuses at the hands of CBP to come forward so that their voices can also be heard. A few weeks ago, hundreds of northern and southern border advocates came to D.C. to meet with lawmakers to talk about what it's like to live on the border, including pervasive abuses by CBP agents that, as Lucy just explained, are a fact of life, and to emphasize that real border security requires better training, oversight, and accountability for border enforcement agencies. The recently filed cases are further evidence that such measures are necessary and long overdue. We hope that these cases will build on the critical advocacy efforts of our colleagues and will inform the upcoming immigration reform debates. Thanks.
Thank you, Melissa. At this point, we'll open up the lines for questions. Operator, will you please let people know how to ask their questions?
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask an audio question, you may do so by pressing the star, then one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, it is star, then one to ask a question. We'll pause to allow any questions to queue.
Thank you. While we're waiting for the questions to queue up, I want to let people know that we're being joined by Sean Rorden, a staff attorney at the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties. And I also want to remind people who have may have joined late that an index of the case summaries are available online at legalactioncenter.org. And you can go to the What's New section of that webpage for a link to those case summaries, which also includes points of contact for each of the cases that we have discussed today. I think we're ready to take questions now.
We'll take our first question from the site of Victor Ramos with Newsday. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to ask you if you could elaborate a little bit more on what specific actions would you like to see the agency take to prevent abuses, and what measures should be included in the immigration reform package to make sure that this is part of the agenda?
Thank you for that question. I think I'll call on Sean and Melissa to provide an answer to that question.
Please spell your names.
Great. This is Sean Reardon, S-E-A-N-R-I-O-R-D-A-N. I'm an attorney at the ACLU office in San Diego. There are things that the agency can do today to curb these types of abuses, and then, as you pointed out, there are also important things that Congress can do as part of immigration reform to try to prevent the types of stories that we just heard from repeating themselves over and over again. Among the things that the agency can do today is to make a commitment to promote human rights, civil rights, and civil liberties on a level paramount to its responsibilities to protecting the country and securing the border. There are concrete ways that could be manifested. One of them is for the agency to dedicate more of its own internal resources to oversight and accountability. Another would be for the agency to take abuse seriously, that when abuses are alleged and substantiated, for the agency to take concrete action with respect to the perpetrators of that abuse. Far too often that does not happen. I'm sure Melissa can weigh in on this as well, but there are also a number of things that Congress can do that will be critical to preventing these types of abuses in the future. Through immigration reform, Congress, at a minimum, should require that CBP reform its training to provide for greater training of its agents on human rights, and civil liberties, to provide for better training on use of force issues, which have been endemic in the Southwest United States region in particular, where there have been a number of fatal and non-fatal incidents of use of force by Border Patrol and other CBP agents. Mm-hmm. And Congress should also dedicate substantial resources to oversight and accountability, including the creation of an independent oversight body that's not within the Department of Homeland Security to ensure that when abuses do occur, that there is real accountability.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Trina. This is Melissa. I would just add to what Sean said that one of the greatest obstacles to accountability on the part of the agency has been the lack of an effective complaint process. And so I think that would be one avenue for improvement in the very short term, so that people like those affected who filed these cases can file complaints and know that some sort of review and remedy, if appropriate, will be in order. There's been a lot of discussion, as I indicated, of the need to establish some sort of border liaison committee, and our hope is that this will be a real working committee that will include voices from border communities who can air these complaints in an honest manner and provide a forum for those complaints to be addressed. And finally, in addition to the sorts of training that Sean outlined, I would emphasize that training is not enough. There have to be quality control mechanisms in place so that once the training has happened, the agents are still subject to regular evaluations and audits as time goes on, and that the agency takes appropriate actions to discipline officers who don't conform with the standards that the agency has set.
Thank you. I think we're ready for our next question.
And we will next go to the site of Jill Rapogel with KPBS. Your line is now open.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So in the first case, you mentioned filing an administrative complaint. Can you tell us a little more about what could actually come of these cases? I mean, what would you hope to achieve with filing these cases?
Matt, could you respond to that?
Sure. So each of these cases is seeking redress or compensation, monetary damages for the harm that the individuals have suffered. And on an individual case level, that's what the individuals are seeking. For example, in the case of the person who suffered both physical and emotional harm, making the Border Patrol accountable for what they've done. And we hope that in compilation and looking at this pattern of practice, and you seeing, you know, a dozen cases filed now around the country, that will also bring greater awareness within the agency. I mean, one of the past problems that we've talked about is this lack of accountability and lack of transparency, and the need for documentation and the need for a clear response to the abuses that are occurring. So we hope that while individually we can seek redress, financial compensation for our clients, that on a more global scale we'll be able to obtain not only the agency to begin to reflect on what needs to change within, but also Congress, as they're getting ready to consider immigration reform, will implement guidelines and restrictions that will preclude certain types of activity that go beyond the mission of the protecting its border.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Are there any possible consequences for individual agents?
That goes back to part of what type of accountability is. So these suits themselves do not create any direct link to repercussions on the individual agents. It would be the agency itself that's paying out the damages, although in some cases you can sue the individual agent. Generally, the agency indemnifies or steps up and pays the damages. But you would hope that given that the agency is going to have to be responsible for paying these costs, that the agency in turn would say, okay, now we have this documentation showing your abuse, and we're going to follow forward with the discipline process.
Next question, please.
And we will next go to the site of Pilar Marrero with La Opinion. Your line is now open.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. It seems that at least on the case of Amelia, these are issues of what happens when these immigrants are in detention. And so whatever happened to the reforms that were instituted supposedly in this administration on detention issues, and where are we in this issue in terms of immigrant detention?
I guess I can ask Joseph if he'd like to respond to that in terms of the immigrant detention situation, how the reforms have affected his particular set of clients.
Well, I don't think there has been any effect in the sense that detention isn't a focus of comprehensive immigration reform, much to the regret of probably everybody on this call and immigration organizations across the country. It's just simply not a focus of the reform effort, and it certainly should be. In fact, you know, we hope by bringing these cases that this will highlight the fact that a lot of the abuses suffered by people who enter the United States and get caught up in our immigration system happen in these detention facilities. And another thing I think to focus on about this is that a lot of these people, including Amelia, are people who are not criminals. In her case, she's a mother of three. She was trying to escape domestic violence when she came to the United States. We talked to dozens of women on a weekly basis who are in similar situations. and they're in detention not because they have any type of criminal record of any type, but simply because they entered the United States and ran into Customs and Border Patrol, and then are subjected to conditions that, frankly, would not be tolerated were they actually criminals in many instances.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Trina?
Yes?
This is Melissa. I just wanted to flag the fact that detention-related issues are a significant focus of many, many immigration advocates who are meeting with people on the Hill who are involved in the discussion. So although we haven't seen much yet in terms of language from the Senate, our hope is that there will be a strong push for recourse to various alternatives to detention, and that some of the problems that we've encountered up to now are going to be addressed. But as Joe said, you know, nothing is for sure.
Right.
And Trina, one more quick point on that.
Mm-hmm.
This is Sean Reardon in San Diego. There is a difference between the long-term immigration detention that Immigration and Customs Enforcement performs and the short-term detention that Customs and Border Protection performs that we're discussing on this call. In the CBP context, there are essentially no standards whatsoever, and that's one of the reasons why you have these horrible stories like we've heard today. So that's one thing that the agency could do today if it wanted to, was institute the kinds of standards that ICE has subjected itself to for long-term immigration detention, and it hasn't done that to date, unfortunately.
Right. Thank you, Sean. Can we have our next question, please?
And as a reminder, if you'd like to ask an audio question, you may do so by pressing the star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. We'll now go to the site of Nellie Decker with the Office of Congressman Mark Vesey. Your line is now open.
Hi. Thank you for doing this call. Just had a question regards to numerical data on CBP abuse cases in order to make any movement on the Hill. I know it's important to have numerical data, and just wanted to see if there was anything, you know, that is reported, a high number that I can use to discuss with, you know, other members on the Hill, other staffers.
I'm going to open that up to the speakers and then also say that, you know, to the extent possible that we can provide information after this call, we would be happy to do that.
This is Matt Adams. I was just going to point out that, and I think that there's going to be a link to this on the website, but the New York University Immigrant Rights Clinic has recently issued a report on data they obtained from the Buffalo, New York sector, and it highlights several interesting things, like the number of citizens and legal residents who have been unlawfully detained. It highlights the monetary awards that are provided to immigration officers and its incentives, and oftentimes dealing with the numbers focus on how many people they round up. And so I just think that's an important resource. And then Melissa can talk also about, I think, the American Immigration Council's report that they issued.
And just to add to Matt's point, this is Betsy Ginsburg at Cardozo. The NYU and Families for Freedom report notes that in the time period that they were looking at, that there were about 300 arrests or detention of people who were U.S. citizens or otherwise lawfully present in the United States, and that number is probably on the low side because there weren't adequate reporting requirements of the agency during that period.
Thank you, Betsy. And just to follow up, I was just wondering how can we as members of the community assist constituents in feeling comfortable in filing these complaints or claims?
Great question. Why don't I call on Sean to answer that one first?
Well, doing outreach in itself to constituents who'd be affected by these practices, I think, would go a long way to emboldening some of them to address abuses that they or their families have been subjected to. through some anecdotal experience, I've seen the power of Congress people getting involved in these issues. I've seen what that does to a community's sense of security, and it can be very significant. So, I mean, I know there are limits to what a member of Congress can do in that respect, but just having the open line of communication and doing the outreach on these issues could go a long way to making that a possibility.
Matt, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would just note that there are several different forms a complaint can take. So here today we're focusing on these complaints under normally the Bivens and Federal Tort Claims Act, but there's also complaints that can be done on a really informal basis to the Office of Civil Rights, to different groups within the agency. So there's different forms that present, I would say, less levels of risk for individuals. For example, maybe someone's been harmed, but they don't want to bring a lot of attention because they have someone in their family who doesn't have status, and so they don't feel comfortable with a formal complaint or a damages action. But they can go through and file a informal complaint with the agency itself requesting an investigation. And again, the more that we get, the more documentation it is, it's going to be easier for those who are working on the Hill to try to call for some greater accountability.
Okay, let's move on to our next question because I know we have a few more in the queue.
We will now go to the side of Manuel Valdez with Associated Press. Your line is now open.
Hi there. I'm just wondering the key difference between the cases where you have a U.S. citizen and where you have an undocumented immigrant. Are there enough grounds to move forward with the cases with undocumented immigrants, given that Border Patrol could perhaps say they were just doing their job of, I think the case in Washington State and out of court is one that stuck out to me.
Okay, well, since Matt is in Washington, I'll let him take the first step at that question.
Great. So one of the points that Trina made earlier is that, as she put it, it's axiomatic that as a law enforcement agency, they should also be required to abide by the law. And whether someone is a citizen or a non-citizen, they're still entitled to certain fundamental rights. So, for example, whether someone's a citizen or a non-citizen doesn't give the Border Patrol the authority to beat them up or to arrest them without having a legal basis. And so on a more practical level, you have many non-citizens and some non-citizens who are undocumented who are subjected to abuses but fear moving forward and bringing these types of complaints. But there's still a legal basis to seek recourse. Of course, as an attorney, I have to weigh with my clients the pros and cons, and part of that is trying to balance whether there could be any repercussions, that is to say, immigration enforcement trying to take further action against them. But none of that undermines the fact that the immigration authorities, whether the person is documented or undocumented, has to abide by the law. And so, for example, the case in Anacortes, you had Border Patrol who went in and invented a basis for arresting him. And I say invented because it makes clear the Border Patrol's own report is clearly contradicted by the police report that was issued at that same time and shows that the Border Patrol fabricated key details about the fact that they didn't even show up at the scene of the stop. And so you have blatant misrepresentations by an agency trying to justify their stop. And there, it's not enough for them to say, well, we think that person's undocumented, so we can do what we want. No, they still have to be accountable, and they still have to abide by the law.
Thank you. Does anyone else have anything to add?
This is Joe with AI Justice. It's probably a good point to make that these individuals that are held by Customs and Border Patrol certainly are protected by various U.S. laws, and part of the problem that we face is that many of the individuals we see in detention, and of course we don't see these people, that's another issue with Border Patrol, is that they're being held in places that we don't have access to. But the individuals that we talk to are in longer-term detention, they're often not aware that they have rights. And in fact, many of the women that we spoke to who were held in Texas at these CBP stations in these Yaleras, they were frankly surprised to learn that it was against the law for them to be treated in the way they were treated. And we didn't hear their stories because they came to us complaining about these problems. We learned these stories incidentally as a result of talking to them about immigration issues. But yeah, most certainly the Customs and Border Patrol agents can be held and their supervisors can be held responsible for a variety of torts and federal law violations, things like neglect, abuse, intentional infliction of emotional distress. And those are the things we're pursuing on behalf of our clients.
I have a quick follow-up.
Sure.
Where is the letter? What's the location of it in Texas? Have you guys seen it personally, or you don't have an idea?
No, we haven't seen it, but it's in an area of Texas called the Rio Grande Valley sector. And within that, that's a CBP sector. And within that sector, there are half a dozen of these. Yeah, they call them stations, Yoleras. There's one in Brownsville, one in McAllen, West Laco, Texas. Those are a few.
Thank you.
Okay, we're ready for our next question.
And again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask an audio question, you may do so by pressing the star, then one on your touch-tone phone. We will now go to the site of Cindy Ariola with La Raza. Your line is now open.
Hi, Cindy. Cindy, are you there?
And it does look like Cindy has dropped. We'll move on to the next question then. Our next question is from the site of Basilisa Alonso with Hispanic Link. One moment, your line will be opened.
Hello.
Your line is now open.
Hi, and good afternoon. Thank you for having this press call. I have two quick questions. Just the site for the materials that I didn't catch it earlier.
Right.
And then my second question is just, do you guys have any idea of how the sequester cuts will affect the resources available for these detention centers and if it would make the experiences even worse in some cases?
Let me go ahead and take that first one. I'm glad you raised that point. The materials are located at legalactioncenter.org. If you go to the What's New section of their webpage, it is the first link under the What's New section. So it's legalactioncenter.org in the What's New section of their page. With respect to your question about sequester, I'm going to throw that to Melissa Crow.
Great. Thank you.
Goodness, I think it may be too early to tell, although we did hear recently that 60,000 CBP officers, which is pretty much everyone, are going to be furloughed. My understanding of a furlough is that it means that you don't work and don't get paid for one day of every pay period. But I can't tell you at this point what that's going to mean for some of the practices and the detention-related problems that we've explained today. Do others have thoughts on this?
Yeah, this is Joe with AI Justice again. I agree with Melissa. I don't know if we could say how it will affect conditions, but Amelia, just so happens, the woman that I was talking to about was released from a Broward Transitional Center, which is an ICE detention facility. It's privately run by the GEO Group. But she was released after nearly 9 months of being detained there at the time of the, you know, all of these other releases that were purportedly related to the sequester and put on electronic monitoring and allowed to leave the state. She's still in the United States, but her case is just a terrific and tragic example of someone being kept in detention who certainly didn't need to be, for, like I say, nearly 9 months. At a cost of, we estimate, something close to $30,000 to U.S. taxpayers, where her being out on electronic monitoring will cost something along the lines of $14 a day.
So she was released as a result of sequester or through?
I don't want to say as a result of, but she was released, you know, a couple of weeks ago in that mass of people who were released at exactly the same time that ICE was saying that, for budget reasons, you know, they were reviewing certain nonviolent, non-criminal detainees cases and selecting alternatives to detention. which are alternatives that, of course, have existed for, you know, since the very beginning, and that we all encourage ICE to look at as a pragmatic and humane way to handle people like Amelia, a victim of domestic violence who was needlessly incarcerated for nearly 9 months at a significant expense to U.S. taxpayers.
Right. Thanks, Joe. Mm-hmm. Does someone else have something to add? Sean?
Oh, we can move on.
Okay. Thanks. Next question, please.
Once again, as a reminder, it is star then one to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment to allow any additional questions to queue.
Okay, I'll use this time to again say the materials are available on legalactioncenter.org under the What's New section of that webpage. There also is contact information for the each of the cases that are indexed on that webpage. For additional, if you want to contact Wendy Feliz at 202-507-7524, she could also direct you to the appropriate person if you have follow-up questions. If we don't have, do we have any other calls?
At this time, there are no additional questions.
Okay, great. I'll thank everybody for joining our call today and for your interest in this topic. We'll wrap up the call and hope everyone has a good afternoon. Thank you.